Thank you, Mr. Chair, Commissioners, Director Murphy. So today I'm going to give you an update on all things shellfish aquaculture. And as many of you are aware, the subject matter is really easy to understand, non-controversial, and it's by far the easiest program I manage as the section chief. So that's how I would introduce today's talk if I was playing the game my daughter likes to play, where we speak in opposites. This is very much controversial and not super easy subject matter to understand. But today's presentation is going to concentrate on the new shellfish aquaculture bill, which was Session Law 2019-37, Senate Bill 648. I will refer to it as the shellfish aquaculture bill from the rest of the presentation, so I don't have to say that every single time. So I'm going to give you a quick overview of that, and then go into some of the things that came out of the bill, the user conflict study, the recommendations that came out of that, and then next steps. So the user conflict study was a joint study that was from the commission and the division, which we had a very tight turnaround on, but I'll get more into the details later in the presentation. I did want to give a shout out and big thanks to everybody that helped put together the study in a very short time frame. So the shellfish aquaculture bill was signed into law and became a...
Jacob, if I can interrupt for you just a minute. Go ahead.
This document, the study, can be found in your library, just like the big book. It's placed in as a separate document, so you do have that as well.
The presentation,
yeah. And the actual study document.
Apologies. Continue.
So the shellfish aquaculture bill became effective July 1st, 2019. It was titled an act to provide further support to the shellfish aquaculture industry in North Carolina. It's been a very busy legislative last few seasons for all things shellfish aquaculture in North Carolina, as many of you are aware. And this bill was passed, which had 12 different sections that we'll go through and speak about. It does include requirements for the commission rulemaking for adopting rules and provides some temporary rulemaking and some options to adopt rules if that is what you choose. So I'm just going to go through each section, try not to spend too much time on it, and then we'll dive into the user conflict study toward the end of the presentation. So the first section that the bill addresses is the shellfish aquaculture enterprise areas. So this gives the secretary and the delegated to the director ability to go out and create these shellfish enterprise areas, which have been utilized in other states to streamline the permitting process for shellfish aquaculture. It has been successful in some states. It's been not so successful in other states, so we plan to try to work with other states to learn from what worked and what hasn't worked. But basically, this is where we would go out as the division and using the same minimum standards that are set up through statute and rule, do site and have maybe a larger track of acres to be able to be leased out, and then we would sublease those basically through a permitting system to potential applicants. So that would make it more efficient to where every applicant that came in didn't have to go through the application process and public hearing and public comment. We would do all that on the front end and then sublease small parcels of the larger parcels to applicants. Another part of this section is to identify potential moratorium areas for these shellfish enterprise areas, and it does give the commission the ability to adopt rules if they choose. So this is something we'll be continuing to work on and trying to do a lot of stakeholder input and going out to meetings over the next few months to try to get input on. The Section 2, the Pemco Sound Shellfish Aquaculture Pilot Project. So this is a project, a 10-year project, where they can have, applicants can apply for up to 3 50-acre tracts in Pemco Sound with no individual or entity ability to have more than 100 of those acres. They have to be 250 feet apart, and that is so try to open it up kind of similar to the shellfish enterprise areas, but also to make it more efficient to where now leases are capped at 10 acres each, and no one person or entity can have more than 50. So that gives people a little bit more flexibility to come in if they do want to start a large operation, to be able to apply for 50 acres and not go through five different application processes. So this does terminate and end on 2031 after the 10 years. So unless something changes statutorily, those leases would be terminated after the 10-year project. And we do have some deadlines for reporting on that. The next section, increased production and planning requirements. So this changed the production and planning requirements for shellfish leases. The biggest change is it took out the culch material for planting. And so you have to have a minimum purchase seed in order to qualify for the planting effort. That is different for extensive versus intensive. Extensive being just culch on bottom, planting seed, where intensive is having cages either on the bottom or water column. It also took out the, that whereas for bottom leases you could plant or harvest, now it's, or plant and harvest production, now it's plant or, so that kind of brings in if we have a large storm or hurricane, as long as you met the planting requirement at the beginning of the season, you would meet your production for the year if for some reason a storm comes and wipes out your harvest for the year. And this does, the legislator did ask the commission to adopt rules similar to these. So section four, transition of terminated leases and gear cleanup. This was actually something that the commission put forward in Amendment 4 of the Oyster FMP back in 2017 as a recommendation. So basically, if a lease was terminated before, if somebody wanted to come and re-lease that, we would have to go do the normal sampling to look for natural shellfish bed, which is no more than 10 bushels per acre. And so obviously, if somebody had leased that, there would be shellfish there. So that would not meet the minimum standard requirements that we have to do when we do a site investigation. So now somebody can re-lease, terminate a lease within 18 months of the time it terminated without worrying about the threshold for natural shellfish. So that's good because that's a footprint we can that another potential grower can then come in and start making productive. And it also required gear cleanup. So before, if a lease was terminated, you only had to clean up the markers, but now the statutory authority to actually get the growers to clean up the gear, too, if they are terminated. Section 5, the transplanting of seed oysters and clams from prohibited waters. This basically opens it up to, as you've seen a picture of FloatSea, floating upwelling system. It gives the ability for folks to grow seed in a prohibited area. It's not every prohibited area. It's still case-by-case basis. With seed, we're less worried about potential bacteriological problems like Shannon was talking about earlier with that size, because by the time they plant the seed to their lease, it's a pretty long grow-out period before it actually goes to market and gets harvested. There may be some still potential areas where there's heavy metal concentrations where we may not allow them, but this does open it up to where people can start diversifying their seed and being able to get it where we've run into problems with importing seed from other states, where other states have had a shortage of seed, which has led to a shortage of our growers' ability to get seed. So the Section 6, administrative remedy for shellfish leasing appeals. So this sets up a three-person shellfish review committee, one of them being the chair, or one of them being a commission member, two of them being public, one public person with expertise in shellfish aquaculture, another person with expertise or knowledge of general land use and development or riparian. So that is, it also lays out the appeal process for somebody appealing. So this one is kind of off the mark, and it's a bit unbalanced because it still doesn't give the ability for the applicant to appeal in the same manner it does another aggrieved person. So now the applicant still, if they do not like the decision, must appeal through the Office of Administrative Hearings. However, if another person appeals, an outside party or another person like a riparian owner, they would have to go through this three-person committee first, and they would decide whether or not it meets the criteria to then get pushed on to the Office of Administrative Hearings. So it's not really going to be a remedy for us, because for us it's the time and resources and commitment to process these cases and the litigation and go into the Office of Administrative Hearings. So it would be preferable if both parties had to go through the same process. But as of now, this is what we have with this administrative remedy. We will be coming back to the commission probably in February with the members of that three-person review committee. We have to provide rules, and y'all have to adopt rules for the process for administrating these appeals. But for the initial set of the committee is really what's important. So if we do get any appeals between now and then, we have the committee set up to actually review them. Sections 7 and 8, moratorium on any new or renewed leases in New Hanover area or Bogue Sound. The New Hanover area goes from Wright's Full Beach Bridge down to Snow's Cut, and it's all of Bogue Sound, so that's a two-year moratorium on any new leases. Section 9, the reduced user conflict study. So we'll discuss that more in depth here after a couple slides, but as I said, it's a joint study by the division and the commission, and there are, the commission shall adopt rules as it's laid out in the bill. So Section 10, the penalties and violation study. So this is a joint study by the division, Department of Justice, and the North Carolina Sentencing and Policy Advisory Commission, which I've tried to commit that to memory and I can't. So, but that is something Carter's been kind of taking the lead on, and we'll be coming back with a study on that, I believe, in March. So finally, the two sections where I don't have to do a study, which is good. Section 11, the Shellfish Loan Program study. Coastal Federation is providing that, and study crop insurance is completed by the Department of Ag and Consumer Services. So both of those have come out of previous legislative studies as a big need for the shellfish aquaculture industry to have a loan program set up and then provide crop insurance similar to agriculture. So this is a busy slide, but this shows all of the rules and statutes that are impacted by the Shellfish Aquaculture Bill and potential other statutes that may be impacted as we continue with the mandates and the studies moving forward. So the rules, all of the 030, 0200 rules, the leases and franchises are up for adoption next year. So we're taking that time to open those and start looking and seeing where the bill will affect those and the changes that revisions that need to be completed. So this table shows the various studies that the shellfish bill requests and the deadlines. And as you can see, the user conflict study is the first deliverable that's due and must be completed by January 1st, 2020. So that's generally what the aquaculture bill, there's a lot of things that have come out of it, a lot of good things, and a lot of work that's coming out of it. And we're really appreciative to the General Assembly for their help and their interest in all things shellfish aquaculture and some of the positions that they have allotted to us. We did get two positions this past budget. If we ever get the budget, we'll get those positions. We did get two new positions to help administer shellfish leases whenever that comes to fruition. So, user conflict study. This was, again, a very short time frame. We had from July 1st to now to complete the study. We had a small work group with the DEQ Council, myself, Commission Council. We updated the chair, and we were meeting weekly to try to get this study put together in a short time frame. So the big takeaway is I want to make sure everybody understands this isn't the end-all, be-all. This report is more of going to lay the groundwork and a roadmap of the work we have ahead to try to mitigate user conflicts and the other directives that the Shellfish Aquaculture Bill asks us to do. So this is just getting us started in the right direction. So again, the report is due to be, or the study is the completion deadline is January 2020. with rules and internal operating procedures reformed by March 2021. And that is another very tight turnaround on trying to complete adoption of rules and looking at rule revisions. So I'll just go through the different aspects of the study. We provided a lot of background information because there's been a lot of good work that's been done. There's been a lot of areas that we've done research on and experience that we've had with user conflicts in the past. The reason this has come to light and the reason that legislators asked this is because just a huge increase that we've seen in the aquaculture industry in just the last few years, and also the changeover of the industry where they traditionally did culture on bottom methods and leasing the water column with more intensive gear, which has led to an increase in user conflicts. So in the report that you have in your ebook, I went through and did a background on the shellfish lease program, the federal permitting that shellfish leases have to go through with the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers nationwide 48 permit, which has regional conditions for all shellfish aquaculture activities. We highlight the increase in shellfish lease applications and the resulting user conflicts over the past few years, which has led to an increase in legal challenges, litigation, lots of staff time, and resources being spent toward addressing these cases. And then just a little bit of information on the need for resources to combat the increase in the workload. So as you can see, there's been an exponential increase in the number of applications that we have received just from 2011 to now. There was a slight dip in 2018 that was due to the hurricanes, Hurricane Florence, Tropical Storm Michael, with it going right back up this year and expected to continually increase. So this figure just shows the total amount of shellfish leases in North Carolina. It actually goes from north to south, starting at Dare County, moving toward New Hanover County. And just a reminder for bottom water column and franchise leases. So bottom lease is exactly what it says. It's a bottom lease. You can have gear no greater than 18 inches off the bottom, and it's not it's typically culture on bottom with some bottom cages. Water column leases have to have the adjacent bottom lease. So if you already have a bottom lease, you can apply for a water column on top of the bottom lease. If you don't currently have a bottom lease, you have to apply for the bottom and the water column simultaneously in order to get the water column. And the differences between franchises and bottom lease is franchises are recognized submerged land claims. If you are recognized submerged land claims, franchises, recognized submerged land claims. It's one of those we won't get into submerged land claims right now. But then you also, if you have a franchise, you do have to apply for a water column if you want a water column on top of the franchise. Same figure, except this is showing total acres. And as you can see, Onslow County beats out Carteret by a hair for this, whereas on the previous slide, Carteret County by far has the most total number of leases. So the different sources that we drew upon for looking at user conflicts. So there's been two previous recent legislative studies, one in 2016 and one in 2018. There was a few recommendations in the 2016 plan, which was completed by the division. The 2018 plan was completed by the Shellfish Mariculture Advisory Committee under the UNC Collaboratory, and they had over 21 recommendations. So I'm a big fan of not reinventing the wheel, and there's been a lot of good recommendations and strategies in those previous legislative studies that haven't had time to come to fruition. So we outlined those and ones that we support to continue trying to mitigate for these user conflicts. Collaboration and public outreach. We've had a lot of great collaboration, so we've kind of highlighted that and then potential areas where we can further that. So user conflict information from other states. You know, I've been in, over the last year or so, in contact with a lot of other states' representatives for aquaculture and shellfish aquaculture. And, you know, there's been a lot of states that are have a lot of experience doing this for many more years than we have. So, you know, we really want to learn from what's worked in other states and what hasn't worked in other states. So they've had a lot of user conflicts, you know, same thing is happening here. So we certainly wanted to use that as a tool in our toolbox. And then the future studies and directives. So with the shellfish aquaculture, user conflict is really tied into everything that is currently happening in shellfish aquaculture. So the future directives from the shellfish aquaculture bill with looking at the enterprise areas and the Pamlico Sound project, all of those will have this incorporated in it as well, because those are all, it's all tied together. So based on all the information, we put together four recommendations for y'all's review today, and I'll go through each of these. So the first recommendation is regulatory reform. So as I said, there's all the 030, 0200 rules are up for readoption, and most of them are affected by the new shellfish aquaculture bill. So what we did was we went through and kind of took a first draft of where we could see potential changes to address user conflicts that we could do in the short turnaround, which the rules are supposed to be readopted by March 2021. So ones that we didn't potentially see having a high fiscal impact, ones that were pretty straightforward. Again, this is certainly not a comprehensive list, and we will be bringing, if y'all vote to approve the study today, we will be bringing all of these rule revisions to you multiple times over the next year for comment, feedback, and before any adoption is done in March of 2021. But the riparian owner notifications, so this is something we've been trying to work on increasing, and in order to address some concerns, we've been working with Coastal Management and the Coastal Resources Commission to address some of the needs or some of the questions that they have and concerns about user conflicts as it relates to navigation. So one of those is having riparian owner notifications input into rule. We want to include more specifics on the commission's authority to limit the total amount of acres in an area. So the commission has statutory authority to limit the amount of acres in a water body that shellfish leases can have. We want to further refine that through rule and actually try to get something, maybe looking at cumulative impacts or percentage of water bodies, and really kind of tease that out in rule. Currently, there's a 100-foot setback between shellfish. We want to put a 250 setback between shellfish leases, because right now there is no setback in between leases, and we want to increase the setback for developed shorelines. Currently, it's at 100 foot. We would like to change that to 250 feet to hopefully address.
When you're talking a 250-foot setback between leases, what if they're owned by the same entity? You still got to have a 250-foot? Are you still looking at that, or is that part of the consideration?
Yes, sir. So it's about navigating around the leases and in between the leases, and it's not about the conflict from the various growers. It's about being able to navigate around the leases. We would also like to change the marking requirements. So now you can basically have an unlimited amount of corner markers. So it averages around 6 to 8, but there are some that we see that are 20, 25, which makes it very complicated for us to go out, and it also makes it more burdensome on the grower. But we want to cap that at 8 for navigation and safety reasons, as well as the burden it puts on the division. Training requirements. Currently, the training requirement is you have to pass an exam 70% in order to get a lease if you're not already a leaseholder. So we want to actually create a training program like other states have that new applicants have to go through to kind of make sure that they know the ins and outs of the industry. Again, the administrative remedy that the shellfish aquaculture bill further defined the process for that. And the one statutory change that we're looking at possibly is the minimum clearance for submerged gear on bottom leases. So back in 2015, the legislators changed to where you could have a gear on a bottom lease as long as it wasn't greater than 18 inches off the bottom, but they did not add any type of clarification on minimum clearance. So you can have an 18-inch cage on a bottom lease without having the water column lease and 20 inches of water, and, you know, 2 inches of water really isn't navigable. So applicants can still use that gear, but they would have to apply for a water column lease. So we want to change that to add a some type of minimum clearance, whether it's 3 feet to the, you know, mean low water mark from the top of the gear to that, to, if it is going to be a true bottom lease, to make sure it's navigable. So the second recommendation is program evaluation. So just looking at the efficiencies or possible efficiencies for the program, make sure we're utilizing the best available science and that we're working with the stakeholders, which we've done a good job. Staff has done a really good job reaching out. But also synchronizing reporting and renewal requirements for leases and aquaculture permits. So currently there's various permits that, depending on the activity you want to do on a lease, you're required to get. But through rule, they have various reporting and renewal timelines. So we want to try to synchronize that, which will lead to further rule revisions. Collaboration. So we are very fortunate that we collaborate with a lot of great folks, whether it's NOAA, whether it's North Carolina Sea Grant, UNCW, North Carolina Shellfish Growers Association. We have a lot of great collaborators, so we just want to further that work. And one big thing is we want to start an interstate aquaculture work group. So all of the other state representatives that I speak to, the number one problem that they have is being able to get in touch with the other states, being able to get their information, because it's most other states like North Carolina where it's a very fast-moving, evolving process. So being able to streamline that to where we can work with other states to see what their regulatory framework is, what their processes are, and create an inventory of that that we can update annually to make sure all the states are working together to try to make their individual permitting processes as efficient as possible. And start aquaculture training programs similar to what other states do. So, of course, in order to do that, we need to evaluate our current staff and funding levels to ensure we're able to complete the recommendations. So, that was the Shellfish Aquaculture Bill update, and as well as user conflict. So, this is kind of next steps and what we need today. If everything is copacetic, we need the commission to vote on approval of the study today, so that way it can move forward for final review and completion. Again, this is just a vote to approve the study and to work forward with the recommendations to try to mitigate user conflicts, as well as the other mandates that are coming up with the enterprise areas. So again, if y'all vote to approve this, we'll start bringing the rules package to y'all in the February meeting to start working through over the next year to hopefully have an end product by the March 2021 deadline.
Great. Thanks for the presentation. Any questions of Jacob? Yes, Tom.
Hey, Jacob. A lot of work's gone into this, so thank you very much. I'd like to pull back just a little bit, though, because we get this sort of as a almost baked turkey. The button hadn't quite popped out, but it's about ready. But I don't, you know, this is a net effect upon fully adoption of the regulations of imposing zoning restrictions across all of the waters within our jurisdiction. And so first thing I'd like for us to ask is, can we get a physical map showing what is covered and what is not covered? Because as you're dealing with the public, if parts of our bodies of water are not going to be subject to this, it's important for them to know. If they are going to be covered, it's damn important for them to know. And, you know, we've seen the pieces of everybody thinks this is great until they end up can't get out from their pier because there's a bunch of gear, you know, that's sitting out of the water, you know, messing up their sunset. And they're going to, you know, folks haven't paid attention to this, and they will. So I'd just like to make sure we're doing our job on the front end, representing both the, you know, the resource that we need to maximize, but also I didn't hear anything from any of the county, whether the county commissioners or those folks have been involved or not, because the landowners that have land and that we're coming technically within 250 feet, but we're expanding a program, which I'm in favor of, but I think it's incumbent upon us to do it the right way and do it with notice. You know, a 250-foot setback, when you got a lot of folks down east in Carteret County who have 300-foot piers, isn't much of a setback at all. I feel like we jumped in to some of these pieces, and if the macro maps were there and I missed them, I apologize, but I was looking for them and I couldn't find them on here. They may be in here and I hadn't found them, but I don't know where we're, what we're including versus excluding at a macro level. And then I do have a specific question of the 3-foot clearance. When I first read that, I thought, well, that will solve the issue of avoiding what we just see there in that picture off of people's waterfront properties 250 feet off of their shoreline. And if the 3-foot submerged the 3-foot at mean low tide, I guess I was looking at that going, well, you wouldn't see that. So either I didn't understand that, I need to clarify what we mean by the minimum clearance for submerged gear. But I am concerned about the 250-foot setback. Now that we're going to review it, I don't think that's sufficient. It may be sufficient in a lot of areas, but there's a lot of areas where it's not and is going to create an impact, an unnecessarily negative impact, user conflict with the property owners, and I'm not sure they've been engaged in this process. So this has nothing to do with the resource under the water, but given that the topic is user conflict study, I'm not sure that I didn't hear any feedback from any of the real estate community, the county commissioners, the folks who would be involved in the ownership of the shoreline. And I'm not trying to sort of say good, bad, or indifferent, but it's incumbent upon us to make sure we're not pulling the wool over anybody's eyes, saying we're listening to all the conflicts if we're not. And so those were a couple of and the other simple question, I get the distance, if we're in the Pamlico, the distance between relative to navigable waters. If we're in Core Sound, we have limited navigable waters to begin with. So again, that's part of where some macro mapping of where this is eligible and is not may help answer a lot of the questions, because frankly, you got very different waters that all get lumped under the waters of the Sound, and what works in Pamlico doesn't work at all in Core Sound or Back Sound, and I don't know how to speak to Onslow Bay, but I don't think this is a situation where, for the sake of hitting a deadline, that one set of one suit's not going to fit everybody, I don't think. And I'm just concerned that you've done a lot of good work, but I see some pieces that I don't. I'd be curious if you've got observations as to how we can get there.
No, absolutely, and you're correct in all of that. So, as far as the report does outline what our plan is to go out and to do a lot of stakeholder, get a lot of stakeholder feedback, and looking at, on a local municipality level of getting, and looking at getting commissioners, going out with local government and mayors and whatnot, but also going out for riparian owners and, all the various stakeholders to try to get input. Unfortunately, the way the industry has evolved so quickly and grown, we haven't been able to get out in front of that with that type of public outreach and input. We've barely tried to keep our head above water, no pun intended. Just keeping up, trying to keep up with the industry, especially with the recent litigation stuff. So we really want to make that effort of going out to various stakeholders and trying to get as much feedback and input and doing a little bit of education too as well. And, you know, the first set of that, we are doing that in December with the Growers Association. That's geared more toward the growers, but we also, as I said, over the next few months, go out to local towns and whatnot and have get that feedback. As far as the setback, right now, the leases can be sited within 100 foot of developed shoreline. So this is increasing it to 250
right.
feet.
It's a good step forward. I'm just, but
you're completely right.
Since we're going to look at all of it, I wanted to make sure we look in a smart view versus just, well, that's better than what we got. But we don't have, we're getting ready to ramp up what we're doing here. So.
And I think a great opportunity for that will be when we start bringing, again, these are just potential rule revisions. We could, the commission could further that and take possibly a regional framework to doing that. There's tons of different options we could talk about when we start bringing those to you over the next year. That was just kind of our initial minimum setback. We know 100 is not enough, and you know, thinking 250 feet would be better. But again, that's something as we move through the rulemaking process, the commission may decide they don't even want that as a potential mitigation for user conflict, and that's fine too. You know, it's basically all the 030-0200 rules are going to be opened up over next year. We're going to be working together to try to include any type of revisions to mitigate user conflicts that we can with a tight turnaround and not obviously jumping into the heavy, you know, fiscal analysis burden of it. But the answer to your gear about the gear, so the just to clarify, the 18 inches for off the bottom, that's just for bottom leases. So that's if you have submerged right. gear underwater. The water column with the floating gear, that's if you have a water column lease. So you're always going to see the floating gear because it just rises and falls with the water. And there are certain minimum standards that are set out in statute that aren't addressed and weren't addressed by the Shellfish Aquaculture Bill, and one of those is compatibility. So, you know, shellfish leases have to be compatible with other public trust uses. We have found that, and this is outlined in the report too, a lot of the litigation and negative feedback we've gotten recently is viewshed, which is not in North Carolina case law defined as a public trust use. So that's kind of the legal gray area we've been getting in court a lot for something that isn't codified in statute or rule, and we can't, or the director can't approve or deny a lease based off of viewshed because that isn't codified in statute or rule.
But and that's exactly why, counsel, I've raised the issue of making the corollary to zoning, which viewshed is a thing. It's a legitimate thing. We can debate how it ought to impact in this scenario or not, but if we're going through this whole process to ignore viewsheds is to stick our head in the sand, because that's going to be the litigation at some point. It already has been up in along the Chesapeake and others, and as we have, that's I think why I asked in the very beginning, one of the things that would be very helpful is if we can determine which bodies of which areas of the waterways we're talking about. Yeah, sorry.
Yes, Steve.
Yeah. So a couple things with this. One, we were given it's a rather odd law in that the requirement is for us to do a study by the date by January 2020, but there's really not – there's no one we give it to. So normally in a law, it will say you have to do a study by a certain date and provide it to the committee on whatever, right? This one, it just says you have to do a study and begin rulemaking. So I see that as flexibility for us. We certainly want, as a courtesy, to provide it to the legislature and to the bill writers for that. The other thing is we have been working for a couple years on a small scale with Dr. James Morris and his program, Ken Riley as well, at National Ocean Services over in Beaufort on spatial planning analysis for shellfish leasing. And so we've sort of taken Bogue Sound, and basically what Dr. Morris and his crew have done is plug as many different layers into that as possible. Navigational channels, riparian buffers, oyster rocks, SAB coverage, marsh fringe, as many things as we can. There's still things we have a very difficult time, as Jacob alluded to, quantifying, and that is existing use. That's really tough for us because, you know, we don't sit out there and do counts and everything for that. So at some point, it's still going to be a call, and it was our idea or my idea to try to move ahead with shellfish enterprise areas as a way to take some of the more controversial areas and sort of take our time to do that work so that we could meet with county planners and with communities, and we could do that legwork, which we don't have time to do under the current law. There are 6 pages of statutes which govern shellfish aquaculture. That's pretty unprecedented to have 6 pages of statute. The whole shellfish sanitation program works off a paragraph, right? And then they develop rules out of that. So it's very difficult to sort of package this up and say this is going to solve anything. And that's really not what we're saying. We're saying these are some ideas we want you to consider, but we're still wide open as to what we can do. And we do want to be very outgoing and meet with the various stakeholder groups. But at the end of the day, this program will remain a not-in-my-backyard issue. That's what it has been since my career started with the division in 1987. So...
Okay.
And it will be that way after we're all long gone. But I think one of the things that will help in that process and get us to a clearer set of legitimate zoning style rules, which is what we're talking about here. So this is, I'm looking at it from above the water looking out. And that's very different than our normal regulations, but yet some of this requires that. And the rules for navigation in Pamlico were very different than the rules for navigation in Back Sound and Core Sound. We got to go where the water is.
Right.
And we don't have an option of finding 250 feet over because there may well be not be any water there. So again, if we could consider step one saying, for starters, we're talking about these areas, if this is permissible. If we could, first of all, figure out what bodies of water, what areas of water we're talking about, and then come back around. But I would, when I was looking at the timelines and others, and it says we shall, adopt rules. Well, we obviously means we need to adopt rules, but we need to adopt rules that we can stand by in the long run. And when we have the regulatory recommendations, I worry that as you go out to get the stakeholder input, if we've locked those down, as we may need to do in order to meet your legislative requirement, we're just making you a pinata when you go out and speak to some of the folks, who are, if you want to go down to the end of this road where all the houses are, $2 million plus and say, well, we're going to go down the edge there. And if they think that 250 feet off of their shore can be an area, that's going to get you a different reaction than if we figure out it's going to be certain areas that where we pre-programmed the reduction in conflict. And that's all I'm trying to say.
So
go ahead. You need to respond.
Okay. So that's, I see what you're saying now, and so this is to me kind of the first step. This is we know, and we're making it very clear in the report that we're going to open these rules up again probably the following year. These rules are going to be open for a while. This is just our attempt at a very first to start. I don't want to call it low-hanging fruit, but things that we know are going to be kind of across the board changes while they're open for readoption. I can certainly see these rules being reopened as soon as we get done doing exactly that, going out to the various stakeholders and looking at the shellfish enterprise areas and getting all of that feedback, as well as working with the other states. So to me, that's also a large component, because other states have programs where, like in Maine, you actually have to go out and meet and have a stakeholder meeting. The applicant does when you initially submit your lease. And so you already have that kind of feedback from the local government and the local riparian owners. So those are things that we certainly aren't going to be able to start solving over this next year looking at these rule revisions, but those are certainly long-term things that we can look at to beefen up the rules as we move forward.
Okay.
Right, this is just the first step. Martin?
Well, first of all, I want to really commend the division for working with a very difficult topic that has lots of aspects to it. Just a procedural thing then, for today, are we being asked to approve the report and all that's in it, or are we being asked to simply accept the report and broadly agree with the outline of the items that are going to be pursued?
What we are doing today, we heard a report on their work, but we are going to vote on the study on how to reduce user conflict related to shellfish cultivation leases. That's all that we are actually going to do, which is something that Sean sent out to us about a week ago, and it's just the framework for the study. We're not doing really anything more than that. We've heard about their efforts, so that's what we're doing.
Okay, so for clarification, we will approve the study, but we're not approving all the details as written in the study, with the understanding that whether it's 250 or 300 or
correct,
or we give the director authority to work with it as we're not approving details of the study.
No, we're approving how we're going to do the study.
Okay,
fair enough.
And
what's involved with it. And with that being said, y'all should have received a outline of the study and how the study should therefore be implemented in an email from Sean. And it's titled Study on How to Reduce User Conflict Related to Shellfish Cultivation Leases. No, it's in an email that you should have gotten from Sean.
It's in the book.
It's in the book at page 235.
235 in the book, okay. Okay. All right. So, if what the chair is looking for is a motion to accept the study.
Real quick.
Yes.
I just have a couple. I don't want to drag us on too much further, but I just have a couple just clarifications to make. So Doug mentioned earlier the 250-foot setback between shellfish leases. So that's all leases, not new application leases.
So most of the new rule, if a setback is required, that would be for any new leases after the time of adoption. So I don't think we would go back and get any existing leases modified. That would be for, just like for the aquaculture bill, that was for any newer renewed leases starting July 1st. So they didn't go back before that time to retroactively implement any of the.
And as far as the marking requirements, you said earlier that you. So are y'all's goals to minimize the amount of posts?
Correct. So we want to minimize while also ensuring the safety. So right now, through the commission rule, the corner markers have to be at least 3 inches in diameter, but they can't be greater than 4 inches in diameter. Well, they can, but that would kick in a CAMA permitting process. So we've been working with the CRC and DCM over this last year to try to alleviate some of their concerns with basically density, like some of these. Some folks that do try to put out a lot of different markers, but also realizing that it can be beneficial to have larger size corner markers for safety of the growers and for safety of people navigating around it. So we were looking at the less amount of the corner markers, but potentially having some of those greater diameter for safety reasons. But yes, overall, having less of those larger diameter markers.
Just corner markers, but isn't there something that's for the not corner markers, but between
The boundaries, between 50 and 150 feet,
right.
You're required to put markers. Again, that would stay at the, 3 inches diameter. Most people use PVC poles. We're just talking about the actual corner markers that delineate the lease from the other surrounding areas.
There's other issues, too. The farther you get down south, the more convoluted the leases become because you're working around more intertidal areas. And we literally have had people apply for leases with 25 or 30 corner markers.
Right.
And so in 2015, when the legislature, against basically the concerns that we raised, gave people sort of the right to use intensive gear on the bottom up to 18 inches, they also took away the requirement for leases to be professionally surveyed. And it is a piece of property, it's transferable. So when that happened, our guys have to go out and map these leases, and they have to do that every year or so to make sure they're not growing or that sort of thing. And so when you put that many corner markers out, it just gets crazy. So we're just trying to codify that back into rule.
Okay, Martin, did you have something you want to?
Well, I'm not sure if it's. Okay. I'd make a motion just, I guess, to continue for discussion.
Okay.
If it's not, I was going to offer a motion that we accept the report as a guideline for moving forward.
Okay. And you're going to second it, Mike? Great. Thank you. Any other discussion on the motion and what we are doing?
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
I'm very appreciative of a lot of the work that's going in here. I will restate my concern that we have not reached out based on anything that was in that I've been able to read. We've not reached out to the Association of County Commissioners, to any of the other property-related real estate, vertical, on-the-ground people, and relative to the conflicts, the shore-based conflicts. And I think that is will become the fatal flaw of an eventual regulatory scheme if we don't go ahead and address it, because those conflicts are going to also be increasing, as well as the ones out in the water balance. I'm also concerned that I can't tell how we are treating, as you say, Steve, the water bodies separately relative to the navigation needs in the more shallow areas where the distance doesn't matter. You have to stay out of the channels. So for that reason, I'd like to see those things addressed, and I'd probably be fine. But until then, I have a heartburn over this.
That's why we're studying on how to reduce user conflict. That's all we're doing, not endorsing it.
Let me be real clear. If I understand where we are, if with this vote, you'll be passing this forward for development of regulations consistent with page 257 of our book.
Development for our consideration.
Right. So when we start presenting the rules to the commission starting January 1st, they could take the form of what the recommendations we have, or they can be more or less. This is just starting that process, and when the rules get opened up for review, at that point it's completely y'all's decision what gets put in there, what gets adopted. Y'all could decide to not adopt any of them or any of the content that we provided.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Any other discussion? If not, all in favor of the... Go ahead, second. Yeah. Okay. Martin, is that your motion?
That's just putting the title of the study in.
Okay. All right. Motion, second. Further discussion? If not, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
One negative vote.
Sorry.
And one abstention. Cross abstains. Hendrickson votes against the studying the conflict. Okay. That's what this is. We're studying how to address the conflict, and that's what you voted against.
I voted against.
That's not what we're voting on. No, we're voting on study on how to reduce user conflict.
Mr. Chairman, with all due respect, when I look at page 257 of our briefing book, there are four sets of recommendations. Number A is regulatory reform.
Okay. Okay, recommendations. They're not in, they're going to come back like we just said. He's going to come back in due time
with the,
after studying.
In January.
Whenever, and we're going to, at that point in time, vote on if this is the measure we want or not. We're just studying it right now. We're talking about it. We're getting ready to think about doing something about it. Okay? All right. So the motion passes 7-1 with one abstention. Okay, I am going to turn the gavel over to Vice Chairman Cross for conclusion of this session. Thank y'all. See y'all tomorrow.